And we are indeed back, as I promised, after a really short break. Let's have a look at some of your comments here. Well done to Unan and the Gardaí. They did a phenomenal job over the weekend. It goes to show a high appearance changes the mindsets. A Garda presence works and needs to be taken on board and implemented locally in all rural areas and small villages as well, not just for rally weekend. A great weekend overall, and thankfully it passed off without serious incident. Tell your guest guards that we disabled people do not park free. We have paid up front for the full year. Thank you so much, as a lot of people think it is free. Kathleen Grant. Thanks, Kathleen. In fairness to Eunan, he was answering the question asked by the listener. I take your point, though. A middle-aged lady from Cork was pulled over because she went in an exit as she didn't know the area. Simple mistake. No speed involved, and she was getting a fine while we all saw some of the carry-on going on. Oh, tell us more. Today is a good day for free speech. US authorities have agreed to drop their demand for Julian Assange to be extradited from the UK after reaching a plea deal with the WikiLeaks founder. Yes, indeed, he's admitted to one small charge. He is out. Now, this caller says we need to get Enoch Burke freed. Well, Enoch just has to say, I'm not going near that school, and he's out. That is all he has to say now. Whatever else he wants to pursue after that, court cases or whatever, but he walks out of jail within an hour if he says, I will not go near that school. In the last 3 weeks, a man who was convicted of rape for got a suspended sentence. A man who assaulted a woman and almost killed her got a suspended sentence. A man who beat his 13-year-old daughter with a plastic pipe got a suspended sentence. This was in three different courts by three different judges. Makes you wonder how all these judges could have the same opinion on what constitutes administration of justice. The judiciary should hang their collective heads in shame. Greg, how's the sunburn going now? Is the lobster face gone? It's there. It depends. Silly boy I am. Thank you for asking. Aloe vera. Aloe vera is the only way I can remember it is if I put on a Coronation Street accent. Seems to be the best for it. But the best thing to do is always wear, as the song says, sunscreen. Morning, Greg. Huge well done to that young man, Keelan Dolan, who ran in twice to a burning house to save the man inside. Such courage. Bless him. Mary. Indeed, Mary. And I have no doubt he'll be recognised for it, and rightly so. Yet again today, you got Sinn Féin councillor talking about the need to invest in the ED and ambulance service. Why did he not make that a priority when he was chair of the Northwest Regional Health Forum, sat and said nothing in his role? I presume you're referring to Jerry McMonagle. He would argue otherwise. Greg, I pay €80 every month for medicine, but last month I needed something else, and because it wasn't licensed, I had to pay €30 extra. Yes, that's right, Greg. Have to take two tablets a night when it used to be one. Ah, yes, but you're still getting the same amount of medicine, are you, I wonder? But again, I don't want to keep asking questions and making you text in constantly, but I do appreciate you getting back in touch with me again, because every day is a learning day, and I learn every day here. Margaret Martin is chair of Newtown Cunningham Community Focus Group. Good morning, Margaret.
Good morning, Greg. How are you?
I'm doing all right. How are you keeping?
I'm doing good, thanks.
Right, let's talk about the regeneration strategy and action plan for Newtown Cunningham. It's set for its launch, and I suppose remind us how this action plan, sort of the main points of it, and it generally was drawn together, Margaret.
Newtown Cunningham Focus Group was set up around COVID time, between COVID, between ourselves and Tidy Towns, Newtown Cunningham and Tidy Towns. And we got together along with the Donegal County Council Community Development Team, and between ourselves we got GM Designs, multidisciplinary, they're a planning team. They have developed quite a few different community and villages plans or master plans over the years. So they come on board. Back in spring 23, we had a community public consultation where we invited the community to come along and meet GM Designs and put their wishes with regards to what they want the village of Newtown Cunningham to look like within the next 10 years or going on forward on to 2040.
So, Margaret, you're confident that the community's fingerprints are all over this plan?
The community, the community have been invited, as I say, in spring 23 to come along, and it was really well supported. It was actually then a joint venture at that stage with the Roads Committee. And currently the roads in Newton Cunningham has been redeveloped, as you see, currently at the minute.
Yeah, it's going to be launched on Thursday, June 27th at 8 p.m. in the Clumben Hall in Newtown Cunningham. And everyone's invited, local groups, organisations, businesses, interested members of the community, also encouraged to attend. What is the purpose of then this strategy? What do you feel it lays out? And I suppose really, to actually attract funding and attract funding in the right places and the right type of funding, you really need a plan like this in place, don't you? This is a very important building stone for the future of Newtown Cunningham.
It is. It's very important, surely. I mean, the focus group has done lots of things through the village at the moment, and with collaboration and, shall we say, good relations with the Donegal County Council, we foresee that we can bring in grants, even short-term grants and to the long-term grants into the village of Newton Cunningham and going forward.
Is this being done in a way whereby the people that will find out, you know, what's in the plan will find out on Thursday? Or can you give us some tidbits of you know, maybe where the locals want to see Newtown Cunningham going into the future?
It's all there drawn out on the master plan. And basically, if you've been through Newtown Cunningham is a big, long village. And basically what we're trying to do is to find a centre point within Newton Cunningham and to give a shared space for everybody, you know, that can come into Newton Cunningham. And, you know, so it's really important that we get the businesses involved and the local people involved, because that's where the strategy is going to go, you know, with the blueprint of the village, you know.
Okay, brilliant stuff. Well, well done. Again, an invite to local groups, organisations, businesses and interested members of the community to attend 8 p.m. Thursday the 27th. That's this coming Thursday, of course, in the Clumben Hall. And see really, you know, where Newtown Cunningham might be going in the short term, the medium term, the long term. But with this document now, it can be that blueprint and funding can be drawn down where appropriate. Thanks, Margaret. Really appreciate it. That's Margaret Martin, Chair of Newtown Cunningham Community Focus Group. Saturday and Sunday, this coming Saturday and Sunday, is that this weekend or next weekend? If you had something come up on Sunday, so say, for instance, you wanted to take me to the football, would you say you're coming to the football next weekend, or would you say you're coming to the football this weekend? And I wonder, sorry, I'm ranting a bit here. I wonder when this weekend becomes next weekend. So on Monday, because I was talking to Shannon here on Monday, even though I was supposed to be off, but anyway, here I am, a hero. I spoke to Shannon on Monday, and she was on about next weekend, and she meant the weekend after the next weekend. Got very confusing. When is this weekend? When's next weekend in your house? Let us know. 086 60 25000. Next weekend is the weekend after this one coming, is it? That's this weekend? I haven't a clue. Anyway, happy birthday to Liam McMonagall in Letterkenny from your godmother in Killigordon. Liam, have a great day, will you? Happy birthday to you. Michelle Doherty is in Fawn. Michelle, happy birthday to you from all of your friends. Geraldine Doherty in Burnfoot, a big happy 50th birthday from your sister, Sharon. Your favourite sister, Sharon. Geraldine, have a wonderful day. And also, just whilst we're on announcements, a lost ring with a turquoise blue stone in it. Blue stones, in fact. It's of huge sentimental value. It was lost somewhere in and around the station house in Letterkenny, or in the car parks at Black Centre, or around Old Dunn's. This ring, the owner really, really wants it back, and it's got far more sentimental value than monetary value. We have the owner's contact details here. So if you please came across a ring with turquoise blue stones, it was lost, they believe, somewhere around the station house, Letterkenny, or in the car park at Black Centre, or around Old Dunn's. But listen, I suggest it could have been lost anywhere. You will know it if you found it. Find a ring, blue turquoise stones. Why don't, if you did find it, you can really make someone's day today and give them a great lift and get it back to its owner. 086 60 25000. We'll pass you on the details. Interesting conversation with Kelly. Brian Field spent a lot of time around Kinkashla area, enjoyed fishing, meeting locals, sometimes in Iggy's bar. He was known as a humble man, but confident in his work. Sean, too, spoke to him, albeit briefly, I believe, on a former incarnation of this show. Let me see. No word on Highland about the hundreds of people trapped in their houses and tortured by official rally drivers practicing for the rally at all hours, all day and night, and blocking roads. Then you wonder why there are so many fatal collisions in Donegal, because car culture is promoted. There's word on it now because you've just told me about it. You know, like, there's not 3,000 texts in of people peed off with the rally that we've thrown in the shredder. And I'm not being smart, or I hope you don't think I'm being defensive. I personally, me, right, I wasn't in and around Letterkenny. I don't live in and around Letterkenny. The only way I can really cover stuff or get information out there is if people come to me with it and then we talk about it. There's no tone here. I simply didn't get the correspondence. And the correspondence I did get as it relates to the rally, and some along those lines, not much has to be said, was read out on the programme yesterday and is available on the podcast. The misogynistic displays on vehicles during the Donegal rally is disgusting, says the caller. In 2024, we say our women are subjected to this abuse. Do the individuals who display such have mothers, sisters themselves? Not a great advertisement for a family-friendly event, in my opinion. In previous years, I have seen some pictures of this stuff, and it's described as misogynistic displays. Is it a bit of crack? Is it revolting? Is it offensive? Give us an example of some of the stuff that was said. I probably can't read it out on the radio, but it would help us understand. That has come up in years past. I didn't hear much about it, but I didn't see any of the stickers either. But what misogynistic displays did you see? As I say, is it a bit of crack, or is it highly offensive and should be stamped out? Let us know. Again, that number for you is 08660 25000. Right. Now, the Silver Tassie Hotel, obviously a very important business in and around Letterkenny. And can you believe it? It is 25 years old this month. Its manager, John Brown, joins us in the studio now. John, good morning to you.
Good morning, Greg. Thanks for having me.
25 years, amazing.
25 years, yes. It's just goes like that there. So it is,
have you been there from the start? Or did
no,
you come
I'm not from the start. I'm there about halfway. I'm 12 years now, so I'm... So as I say, we're celebrating this. It was this week, 25 years ago, that the actual hotel itself opened. Mm-hmm. So it is. So we're having a night now on Friday night as a celebration, just to thank all customers, staff, past staff, and everything for the support over down through the years. Just,
yeah, because you know these buildings contain so many memories, so many important milestones.
Yeah.
It could be your communion, it could be your marriage, it could be confirmation, it could be a meal after someone's passed.
Just.
You know, and we talked about this with the recent launch of a book last week. We often associate with food and drink, but these spaces contain so many memories.
It's the memories that we're looking for, as I say. That's why we want to invite everybody back. As you say, it's down to celebrations, even just a normal night out, which turns into a great memory for someone, and that's why we're just asking anyone if they have any old photographs, any old stories, to share them with ourselves so we can have them on display for this Friday night.
Yeah, exactly. The Silver Tassie, always called the Silver Tassie?
No, it was actually the Silver Tassie. There was originally there since the late 1800s as a public house. It was then Boyce's Halfway Bar back then. I think the Boyce family had it up until then, the mid-1980s. I think the rugby club took it over for a while, and then Teddy Blaney bought it then, I think in the late 1980s. So he did, and he called it the Silver Tassie then. It actually came from a pub in Dublin. So it did, where I think in the 60s he first started working in bars, which is called the Silver Tassie. It's also a play by Sean O'Casey, so it is. And then when you translate it, it actually means a silver goblet. Mm. So when he bought the Halfway Bar then, the family renamed it the Silver Tassie after his kind of first experience of the hospitality trade.
And there was a bar offering at that point.
There was a bar offering at that point, yeah.
And at what point then did accommodation get added on?
It was a bar at that point. I think Teddy ran it himself until maybe the early 90s. Then Teddy's son, Kieran, and his wife, Rose, took it over. It was 1999 then that... first bedrooms were built on, and then, as I say, what we have now is a current public bar and lounge and restaurant that was built back then. Then over the course of the years, then I think from 2002 to 2009, extensions, further bedrooms, seascape spa added on, our Woodlands wedding suite was added on. So down through the years, it's been slowly but surely built on and extended.
And is it clear within the building where the original part of that building is? Like, I'm thinking of Logues and Cranford. It's sort of built around an original part of that. Or
yeah,
well, Harvey's Point, you can see where the you know, it's effectively a wall and a fireplace now at this point. Yes. But you can pinpoint where amazing building.
Yeah, well, the actual bar, the actual main public bar, which is centre of the hotel, would be the original site of the original public house.
Yeah.
So that's so again, we're renaming it as a kind of homage to Teddy himself at the time, from when he started off the Silver Tassie.
Well, hold on a second now. So the wee bar.
Yeah.
What do you call it? Not the actual name, but it's called the wee bar now.
The wee bar,
it's going to have a name on it.
It's going to have a name on it.
And when's that being revealed, or is it public knowledge now?
Yeah, well, it's not fully public knowledge, I say, but it'll be revealed on Friday evening, so it'll.
So it's named after Teddy?
At the minute, it will be a homage to Teddy, yes.
And how many words are in the name?
Well, I'll just say two words, so.
So is one of them bar?
One of them could be bar, yes.
I think I've cracked the case. Is there an apostrophe in it?
There could be an apostrophe as well, Greg. You're right, yes.
All right. But isn't it a lovely thing, though, as well,
yeah,
to sort of mark its history and people important to that history?
Oh, yeah, exactly. And there's a few other things. I'll just say Teddy's wife, Rainey, will be, there'll be a wee section of the bar kind of dedicated to her as well, because obviously she was in the background down through the years. So she was, as you always say, the real boss, as I say. So, but it'll be a homage to her as well.
But to get it from its humble beginnings, and even its humble beginnings in its current form, to be, you know, the award winning facility as it is, you know, like, especially if it's chosen as a wedding venue.
Yes, yes.
Very, people are very particular now, so it has to be to a very high standard, and that's achieved.
Yeah.
And also, to if you open up a spa. Yeah. The clientele now, be they local or travelling from great distances, there's a very high bar level.
Oh, there is, yes.
So everything has to be in this day and age, because customers are so discerning at the very highest level, doesn't it, John?
Oh, it does. It's all about, obviously, as you said, your quality and the level of it, but the main thing is consistency. It's getting that consistent day in, day out, 7 days a week. You're only as good as your previous treatment, your previous meal, your previous wedding. So it's getting that right every day. And now that's where I have to give credit to Kieran and Rose, as I say, to put the hard work in over the last 25 plus years. So they have. And I just want to congratulate them both on their success.
I have great admiration for people in business, because, you know, you can, there's lots of people. I probably would be one of those that if something was going kind of okay for me, I'd rest on my laurels.
Yes.
But then you need a certain type of personality trait where you say, well, what about if we spent millions on this, would we recoup? Would it be successful? Could it crash the business? I'm speaking generally now, not about the Silver Tassie, but you need that vision, don't you, and that plan.
Yes, and you need that drive as well to want
footprint of a building.
It is a big footprint. Like, now at the minute, we have just over 100 staff there, so like you have to think about them when you are planning ahead and everything you got there, as you said. No. But you obviously, every year you want to put money back into the business, and you have to develop. You have to develop over the course of time to stay on top. So
you mentioned staff there, and every business is as good as its staff.
Yep.
And I think an awful lot of people have been through over the 25 years.
Yep.
You'd love to see as many former staff again too, because you're talking about memories.
Yes.
They would have some crackers.
Yes,
I would say.
That's it. We're looking, as I say, we have an invite out, as I say, for any present staff, but a lot of past staff who've put the hard work in and made us what we are today. Like, we still have staff there from the original day the hotel opened, still working there. Like, we want to thank them, so we do. And also, as the staff that have come and gone since, as I say, and we'd love them to come back and hear their memories and their stories and the crack that they had back in the day.
And in terms of you as a manager, are you sort of down the old school route whereby you started there and you've worked in every area of the business, or did you come in a managerial position?
No, I came in a managerial position. I worked in other premises.
Not to say that you don't.
No.
Your hands dirty, right?
You do sometimes get the hands dirty. No, but as I say, I started in the hospitality trade maybe about, I think it was about 30 years ago, 25 years ago. I was washing glasses, and I just worked my way through up to where I am now.
Yeah, so you did the groundwork, but just in a different premises of yes, that experience.
Yes, yes.
And I think you have to. I think a good manager, if you ask anyone to do something, I think if you've done it yourself, then you have a better understanding of it, don't you?
Well, I feel like, as I always say, I wouldn't ask myself of any staff member anything to do anything that I wouldn't do myself still to this day, whether it be clean a floor, wash a toilet. That's probably if anyone who comes into Tassie knows that you don't see, for example, myself or Kieran or any of the owners in the office. It's they're there, sleeves rolled up, working
so
hard.
Important. Yes. It really is. And I don't know why it's important, but if you are a clientele, you know, it just makes sense. And the spa's going really, really well.
Very well,
I've done a bit of a tour of spas. That's one of the last ones on my list, so definitely I'm going to get in there before too long. So it's a rich tapestry of offerings. Yeah. And what are the plans for the future? I mean, obviously, it's a constant. It's always reinvestment.
As I say, we closed a week in January there, done a few improvements. As I say, painting all floors done, kitchen got an upgrade, so it did. So again, now we're planning ahead now for next year after the busy season stops again. What to do next, as I say, it's just constant improvement, as I say, and renovating things they got there. Just
and how are things looking for the summer, generally speaking? I'm not looking for you to open up the books.
Oh, no, very
just
very good.
In terms of, you know, interest in visitors and stuff.
Oh, well, very good. As I say, the last month or so, the visitor numbers, we've seen an increase, especially in midweek and accommodation, food offerings, everything out there.
Fantastic.
And now looking through to the summer, wedding-wise, as I say, we're well booked out. Same for accommodations, looking very good. We're just off the back of a busy weekend of Donegal Rally. Yeah. Just also want to congratulate the Gardaí Donegal Club and successful brilliant weekend. So it was. Now.
And you, are we still seeing a strong sort of internal market from, you know, a lot of the staycations and stuff? Yeah. A lot of people down from the north is overseas.
A lot of people down from the north.
A lot of
people down from the north. Obviously, that would be Donegal's biggest holiday market. Also, a lot of local market. But no, I have seen a lot of foreign market in the last 6 to 7 weeks now coming, which is nice to see now, because there for a while it kind of had quieted down, obviously, during the lockdowns and everything out there. But it's nice to see them starting to come back.
And I think bouncing back maybe quicker than a lot of people have anticipated above, you know, not necessarily us, but people who claim to know.
Yeah.
All right, brilliant stuff. So the Silver Tassie, it's 25 years. We've almost unveiled the name of the new bar. But
don't give it away now.
No, but go along and enjoy the celebrations and bring your memories with us. So when are the celebrations again?
Friday night from 8:30 onwards. So there'll be late food and refreshments for everyone, live music and all, and obviously there might be a few old photographs of certain people put about as well.
Some might be more keen to see them out than others.
Exactly.
All right, brilliant stuff. Well done to you, John, Kieran and Rose and the team.
Yeah.
I think any time a business, especially that has grown so much, marks 25 years, it's a remarkable achievement.
Oh, it is, yes.
And our local businesses, it's not just the Silver Tassie, but it contributes so much in terms of employment and supporting in the community as well, too.
Exactly.
Which is also very important, I know, to the team there. But for now, John Brown, manager of the Silver Tassie Hotel, enjoy the celebrations.
Thank you very much, Craig.
Now, the Irish Catholic bishops have issued a letter stating their opposition to legislation resulting in the introduction of assisted suicide or euthanasia or assisted dying, as some call it as well. The Bishop of Elphin is Bishop Kevin Doran, and he joins us on the programme now. Bishop, thank you so much for your time today.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
Right, so talk to us about the context of this, the content of this letter and the points that you wish to be getting across in it.
Yeah, okay. So the letter goes together with a video which we have produced. It's a 30-minute video where we have actually spoken with people who are working in healthcare and also family members of people who have died with terminal illness and one or two people who are currently ill. And I suppose what we're trying to do in the letter is to outline the essence of the church's teaching about care for people at the end of life. And then the video, I suppose, in a sense, is designed to reflect this in a visual way. So really what we're saying is that we understand, obviously, from our own pastoral experience, the people who are in terminal illness find that it can be very challenging and difficult, and sometimes find it very difficult to see the gift that is life. And that this can also be the case for people who are concerned with their care. But at the same time, we believe that in the 1 week of terminal illness, people need to be accompanied and supported rather than abandoned. And that in that period of time, say the last months or weeks of terminal illness, people find themselves sometimes in a space which is no longer filled with machinery and technology, but where they can be accompanied by family members. Friends,
yeah,
chaplains.
Bishop. I've wondered about this, and I still haven't really found a satisfactory answer. And I'm not coming down on either side of this really as such, because you know sometimes you have to walk in someone's shoes to truly understand it. And I'm open to be influenced one way or other. But what I haven't really been able to establish is the driving force behind this. I talk to an awful lot of people on air and off air. Not many people are saying, really, you know, at this stage, we really need to be cracking on with some legislation on assisted dying. You know what I mean? It's not on the tip of everybody's tongue. And yet here we are on the cusp of it being introduced. And as I say, I still can't really determine who is driving this and what is the actual motivation behind it.
Well, personally, I believe it's ideologically driven in the same way that abortion is. And that's part of the reason why we're also that when people say that they will introduce assisted suicide or assisted dying, whatever they like to call it, with all sorts of protections and stuff. We know from what has happened in countries such as Belgium and the Netherlands and Canada and in the state of Oregon in the USA that very quickly those protections, so-called, disappear and there is a proposal to widen things. And I think at the end of the day, I'm not as familiar with it, with the commercial element of it in terms of assisted suicide. But certainly in the case of abortion, I think we do know from research that has been done that it's a big business.
As you mentioned, the legislation in its first incarnation would primarily apply to those diagnosed with incurable, irreversible, progressive and advanced illnesses or medical conditions that would cause death within 6 months. I think even the biggest advocates of this would have to concede that it's very likely that this system would probably end up being aligned with what we see in other countries, because next thing you know, it's like, well, why should I have to travel to Belgium on diagnosis of something when it's legal here in 2 years' time? It's very clear to see. And that's not, again, not taking a side. We just know how things work. And those who would have been opposed to the introduction of the abortion legislation, and it is in now and it is what it is, would also have to also recognise that it has been reviewed again, and that the scope and accessibility can be narrowed, but often is widened. So what people may be asked to vote on is an initial incarnation. And after that, it's up to legislators how broad it becomes down the line. There's no lock-in, there's no guarantees there.
Yeah, well, this is the point that we would make, to accept the principle that it's okay for one person to take the life of another person or to be actively involved in that. Then you undermine a very fundamental principle that makes society civilized. I kind of remember as a young priest teaching in a vocational school in Dublin, where some of these questions, you know, came up in religious education, you know, the whole question of the right to life. I mean, I remember raising with kids the question, why is it that, you know, if a horse breaks its leg, you know, we say it has to be put down, but when that happens to your granny, we don't. And I think the reason for that clearly is a human person is a very different type of ability to an animal.
But Bishop, we do use medicine towards the end of people's lives to alleviate their pain. And could I be contradicted in saying that at times too, that medicine, you know, particularly when certain lines are put in or certain actions are taken, can shorten someone's life to relieve them of their pain ultimately. So we can't pretend pretend that doesn't already happen. Okay, so when you see someone who is really doesn't want to get to that point, is it a massive leap to employ similar medical practices somewhat earlier?
Well, I think it's the difference between giving people assistance to ease their pain while respecting their life on the one hand, and on the other hand, making a decision that's specifically directed to ending their life. And the church has always argued that, you can use medication which may shorten life, provided the benefit to the person is significant, but that there must never be a direct intention of ending life. But we don't, for instance, we don't argue that people should be alive at all costs. And I think we certainly don't recommend that people who are terminally ill should in all cases be resuscitated if they have a cardiac arrest, for instance, and there are protocols in place for that. And that's simply about accepting the fact that death comes, and that we accept it when it comes, but we don't bring it about.
Yeah, and I'd be familiar with how assisted dying works in other countries, as most people do. I think anyone really, it's always good for people, I think, to check stuff out themselves so they have an understanding of it. And I've spoke to people who've been involved in this area, and the way it is in Belgium at the moment, pretty much on diagnoses of an illness that some people can live for 40 years, you can end your life. And it's you take a vial and you consume that vial yourself and you pass away in the next couple of hours. I think it's just important, if people eventually have to vote on this, that they get a full understanding of exactly what it is and what it means. Because what we often see in these debates, and I can understand it, is we see the very emotive arguments, and sometimes the truth lies somewhere in between.
That's right. I mean, the situation it obviously is that if people speak about people in terminal illness suffering impossible pain and during terrible circumstances. And I mean, when you talk to people who work in palliative care and whose job is to help with pain management, they will tell you, first of all, that a lot of the pain that people experience in terminal illness is emotional and not just physical, because the physical pain can be managed very well. And the emotional pain is best managed by giving people space to talk. And our experience, and my own personal experience, and I'll just give you one example of a parish priest with whom I worked back about 25 or so years ago. He wasn't a very communicative person at the best of times, but he was in a final stages of terminal illness, and I went to see him in the hospital. I said to him, "How are you today?" And he said, "Well, I'm not really so good." And I just was somehow inspired to say to him, "So, are you afraid?" And he said, "Well, to tell the truth, I am." And that was the beginning of a conversation which he was having, not just with me, but I think beginning to have with himself. And I think people need space for that. And then there can be, I think there are experiences of people in situations of terminal illness who are carrying a burden related to, something that happened in their life or some breakdown of a relationship. And that sometimes in that space, there's a possibility of healing. which might not be so easily recognised, you know, in everyday life.
Just finally, before you let you go, a couple of callers actually asking the same question. Would it be a sin to aid someone in assisted dying?
Well, yes. I mean, I think the thing is, it's never a sin to help people who are dying by accompanying them, but to do any act which contributes to ending their life. That's one of the big problems that we have with the proposals of the Oireachtas Committee, is that they basically say that in any case such as this, doctors and nurses will have to be present and accountable. And therefore, you're asking people whose job it is to be advocates for life to actually be involved in taking the lives of their patients.
Yeah, okay. A lot of conversation to be had yet. Bishop Kevin Dorn, Bishop of Elphin, thank you for your time today.
Thanks very much, Greg. God bless you. Bye.
You too. Bye-bye. It's a tough one, isn't it? As I say, we've spoken to people, by the way, who've advocated very strongly in favour of that, just in case you think we're taking a side. That's not really how it works. We will have various voices on that. A caller says, as with abortion and assisted dying, the decision is down to the individual who's availing of these services. Watching someone suffer near the end of their life when you know they aren't going to get better is beyond heartbreaking. If you don't agree with it, don't do it. And I get exactly what you're saying, but it is not just down to a personal decision, because there are those that suggest that the ramifications of this could go far beyond the specific subject matter, in that some people that are involved in healthcare, they are concerned that this might change really the whole approach to end-of-life care. There are those who might take this decision because they don't want to burden their family. So it's not because they want to die or because they're in pain or suffering. It's just they don't want to be a burden to other people. So, you know, the ripple effects of a decision like this across society, it does affect us all. So it doesn't then just become a personal decision in relation. I'm talking of assisted dying here. So what we have to make sure is we talk all of that through and that we inform ourselves and make the right decision whenever it's time for us to make that decision. And for some, it's very simple. No one should have to suffer if there is an alternative. For others, it's like, if we do this, such and such could happen. So yes, it's an individual decision, but when things change, when big decisions are made, and it's not just the people directly affected by it, I hope I've made that point as clear as possible. Okay, we're going to talk more after this quick break. Dr. Susan Brannick is Clinical Director with AWARE and joins us now. Good morning to you, Dr. Brannick. Thanks for your time today.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Right. Now, a new study has found that more than one in three, in fact, older people are experiencing symptoms of depression. So talk to us a little bit about that. What is the reality behind that that statistic?
Sure. So this is research that we carried out in AWARE, and thanks to the funding from the Community Foundation for Ireland, which allowed us to explore really the experiences of mental health and older adults. And as you say, we found about a third of people are meeting the criteria for mild to moderate levels of depression. So that's people over the age of 65. And we found kind of very similar themes in the study in terms of people living with a chronic illness as well as living alone were more likely to experience depression. We also looked at experiences of anxiety and found about two-fifths of our respondents were meeting the criteria for mild to moderate anxiety again. Similarly, living with a chronic illness and women too are more likely to experience anxiety for this age group. So we also wanted to find out a bit about loneliness and social isolation, because we know those impact on mental health, not just for older people, but for people across the lifespan. And we found about a third of people, again, were experiencing sort of a lack of companionship, feeling lonely, as well as feeling isolated from other people. And again, those experiences of loneliness, as we might not be too surprised about, were higher among people who were living alone or with a chronic illness. So there's clear themes in terms of general health, in terms of long-term conditions, and how that might impact on mental health, as well as kind of social integration and connection.
Yeah, I mean, historically, we would have to, those of us who aren't affected by this, we would sort of have to say, well, I wonder what that's like. many people listening to this programme will have had an insight from that. You will hear of people during lockdown, for instance, in their early to mid-20s, being trapped in the house, that sense of isolation and the impact it had on their mental health, and we're still dealing with that now. So we are in this position now whereby many people of all ages might have a better understanding of what our older generation are feeling through their isolation and loneliness.
Yeah, and as you say, that we can, at any age, we can have an experience of loneliness or feeling disconnected from community, you know. Certainly in the study that we found since COVID, this older adult age group, the people who were scoring in the range for depression and also living with a chronic illness were reporting kind of more problems with memory, kind of fear of falling, as well as social disconnection since the pandemic. So I guess it may affect people in different ways depending on the age group too.
What can we do about it? I know Aware is offering free life skills program, and we hope that that does have some impact, but it only will have an impact on those that reach out to you, I believe. So, but what can we do as a society? I'm just thinking the traditionally, the post office, the pub, the Garda station, the fabric of Irish community, a lot of that now is not there. And the opportunities for interaction, even the postman or woman arriving, even that's less frequent than it might have been in the past. So whilst I commend the work of Aware, I just wonder what we can be doing as a society to do more to help these people.
Yeah, and as you say, so in Aware we are offering a free life skills program for older people. So that's starting on the 8th of July. So I'd really encourage people to look on our website for more information on that, or call our phone line, which is 1800 80 48 48. So that's based on, I guess, maybe understanding mental health, building resilience and confidence, as well as finding a place to connect with other people, which, as you say, is really key. So in terms of seeking out help, that can be one option. I suppose more broadly, we are currently having a health service that is underfunded in terms of mental health. So the current mental health budget is about 6% of the overall health budget, when recommendations really are, it should be around 11 or 12%. Mm-hmm. So that's another aspect of this, that in order for people to reach out and seek help, that help needs to be existing in services, which needs funding. So that's a government issue in terms of policy and progressing that. And I suppose then in terms of what we can do as a society as well, as you say, things have changed. We've also contacted colleagues at Alone, who, as you know, offer befriending and input with older people as well.
They're under-resourced as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess there is significant needs around.
I was flabbergasted in chatting to Alone with the amount of interactions and the backlog in terms of, you know, just that. Some of their services, the amount of interest just in our part of the world here. Susan, also too, there is a lot going on in different places. You know, and from sitting in this chair, I've spoke to different organisations. It can be, you know, social events or sports clubs that are age appropriate for all people of different disabilities. I would love to see us do more. Obviously, we need to sort of increase what's there, but there's a lot there. I would love to see us be able to do more to connect the people that feel lonely and isolated. And it is a bit of a rabbit hole, because once you, the longer you're in that, the more difficult it is to step out. But I would love if we could do more to connect the people we're talking of here, at least some of them, with the stuff that is probably going on their doorstep. And I don't know how we actively do that, but I think that would be a great help.
Yeah, I think it would be a great help. And as you say, there is a link which our survey found, which is in line with the rest of the research, that loneliness is related to depression and anxiety. So as you say, the more kind of lack of social interaction you might have, the more lonely you may feel, may well then impact on mood and confidence. So it can be harder to take that first step to get out and do something. So I suppose it is really important to see what's available in the community. Aware also run support groups where people can meet to talk about their mental health kind of more generally. They run across the country in person and online. So I suppose really it's taking that first step, isn't it? So it's maybe acknowledging that you might want to do more but aren't really sure where to start. And as I said, Alone are a good organisation to support in that too.
Okay. But if we can do anything as well, obviously we're more than happy if anyone's listening and they think we could provide something of use in that regard. For now, Dr. Susan Brannick, Clinical Director with Aware, thank you for your time. Have a wonderful day.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. Take care. Susan Brannick there. Greg, there are strong indicators that the government's resolve to ratify the EU migration pact could be wavering after the vote was postponed till tonight, I think. Why are opponents of this deal being muzzled on Highland Radio? Caroline, are you muzzling any... Like, are you a firewall here? Are you a gatekeeper of these comments? No? And we contacted this caller to see if they might speak. Yeah, it's a perception. I don't understand. I really quite find it quite frustrating, if I'm honest with you, because we actually invited this person on to talk about it, and it's as if we are sort of opponents, muzzling opponents to this migration pact. I really find that quite frustrating, because it couldn't be any further from the truth. It should be compulsory for everyone when they reach 50 years of age that they make a living will and to be answered that if they get a certain incurable disease, they have the option to receive assisted dying. Cruel when you wouldn't let a pet dog suffer, but the law won't let the person suffering no choice in their dilemma. I understand, and that's a very strong point of view, It's very difficult to sort of say, well, that's a ridiculous argument, because if I were in that position, what would I want? What would I do? I don't know. I'd have to discuss with my family. I don't know. Did anyone else get their bins full of rubbish from people following the rally? Thank you. Oh, no, didn't. Yeah, that's an interesting one. Greg, the bishop is correct. Our lives are not our own. We are all God's creation. God gave us life. It is his to take away in his time. There's a purpose in suffering. Read the story of Job in the Bible. That comes in from Mary. But if you don't subscribe to that, then the argument sort of falls a little bit. I take your point. I'm not contradicting you. Nothing done about horrendous exhaust noise constantly all weekend. Nothing. And since when did yellow plates become legal? Asks a listener. Enoch Burke should not have to say any such thing, Greg. That is your opinion only, and not the opinion of we, his supporters. These are Enoch's religious beliefs. No, I'm not questioning his beliefs. I'm simply saying that if he wishes to leave prison today, he just has to say he's not going near the school. I've been at pains to say every single time I've said that. We can discuss about what led to that and his religious beliefs got him there. But he could walk out and use his platform in the public to continue to press his views. He's in prison at the moment because he refuses to comply with a court order, which means he can't go near Wilson School. That's not really open debate. That is the actual fact. We can debate whether he should or not, of course, or we can debate should he have ever found himself in that position. But the bottom line is if he wants to leave prison this morning now, within half an hour, he simply has to say, I will comply with the court order, meaning I won't turn up at the school. I won't turn up at the school that I'm suspended from. I don't think that's not a controversial statement. It's an absolute statement of fact. That's where we have to leave it on the show today. Thank you to all of you who listened to the show, those of you who watched the show, and those who text in. And hello to you listening on the podcast, or indeed if you're listening to the overnight. We love you too. We'll be back tomorrow morning at 9.
At the Bord Gáis.